What's the 411? You're tuned into 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield. Samples collected in August 2016 by Dr. Don Axelrod and graduate students in public health at FAMU indicated that Leon County school children were exposed to dangerously high levels of lead in the school drinking water. Lead in water is responsible for lower IQ, hearing problems, learning problems, hyperactivity, and attention deficit disorders, retarded growth in children. Adults can experience cardiovascular, kidney, and reproductive problems. Joining me here at the roundtable, I welcome Dr. Don Axelrod, Assistant Professor, FAMU College of Pharmacy and Pharmaceutical Sciences, Institute of Public Health. Welcome to 411 Team, and your three graduate students.
All also call me Fashaken is the name.
Okay.
David Gbugbu.
Okay.
Markina Boyd.
Well, I want to welcome all of you to 411 Teen and really say I appreciate you taking the time to come and share your information and expertise with me and my listening audience. Dr. Axelrod, share with us the circumstances surrounding the sampling of water in Leon County schools, please.
Certainly. Several of us considered that drinking water may have a lead issue in Leon County Schools, Wakulla County Schools, and this was precipitated by the news on Flint, Michigan. Initially, Dr. Ron Saff, a local physician, Dr. Vincent Salters of the FSU Mag Lab, and I discussed this, and then we contacted the superintendents of schools in Wakulla County and Leon County. Now, Flint, Michigan was a exceptionally difficult issue. We don't have anything like that in this area. But still, the levels of lead that can cause problems are quite low, and we wanted to see if we had any issues. The water coming out of the ground in Leon County, Wakulla County, is just fine. Unfortunately, we have not had regulations on plumbing materials for very long that prevent lead from getting into the water. So in some places, lead pipes have been used. Certainly, lead solder to connect pipes has been used. In some fittings, brass fittings in particular, contain up to 8% lead. So this is a source of lead to the drinking water.
Was there any indicators that led you all to this? Was there something going on that made you go, maybe I need to check out the lead in the water here?
What got me thinking about this is the various regulations put forward by the EPA. It's only 1986 that they reduced the lead in fittings for plumbing such that they're reasonably okay. So if there's a school built before 86, it could be problematic. There could be lead leaching from the fittings into the drinking water.
What did your sampling involve, and when did your students participate in the...
The sampling involved going to the schools, and we got very good assistance from both Leon County and Wakulla County. Mr. Fossekin, Mr. Bobu, helped Dr. Alan Becker of FAMU and I do the actual sampling. And for Wakulla County, we went to the 8 schools the night before the sampling, and we bagged drinking fountains and cafeteria water taps. Big sign on there, FAMU sampling, do not touch. We wanted the water to sit in the pipes for 18 hours, which gives us a maximum level. It tells us if fittings and pipes are corroding and releasing lead to the water. So we did this the day before, and first thing in the morning, we came back and we sampled water. We then took that to the FSU Mag Lab for analysis. And we reported data to both Wakulla County and Leon County as soon as we got it.
Okay. Now, what was your... David?
Yes.
Yeah, what was your role in this? What did you do?
My role was to help, as the doctor said, to bag the the fountain, and then when we went to the cafeteria as well. So we were involved in collecting the water samples, and as well, before collecting the water samples, we cleaned the bottles as well. Yes, at the Mag Lab.
Okay. As well. And what does that cleaning involve? I mean, is there a special process involved in the cleaning, or is it?
Yes. There is a special process involved where we use chlorine acid to clean the bottles and wash them, and then store them for some time, and then clean them all over again so that we don't get any other metals or materials getting into it and contaminating our water samples.
Okay. And what did you find?
Yeah, it was quite fascinating when Dr. Axelrod brought the results, and we saw that some schools had quite high level of lead in them. We need to understand that there's basically no safe level for lead, but some of the schools had higher than the EPA recommended lead level, which is 15 parts per billion. And after then, we recommended that remediation actions be taken to make sure that those lead levels in those water are brought down.
Well, and what was the actions? What were the actions that you suggested, Peter? Can you address that, the actions that were taken?
When we reported the results to schools this in August, we reported results on a Friday, and by Monday they had taken action to flush pipes, that is, let water run through the pipes to clean them out. The lead levels in water are highest when the water just sits there. And so the Monday following our sampling, Leon County Schools in particular flushed the water at two of the schools, flushed the pipes, I should say, at two of the schools, and the levels went down from 25 to 1 in one case and from 18 to 3 in another case. And those levels are acceptable. And in one case, they now have an automatic flushing system. It runs water through the pipes for 5 minutes every morning to make sure that lead levels remain low. Leon County will take additional action. They've hired a consultant to look what other actions they should take to keep lead levels low.
Now, what other kinds of things can they do, Markina, to keep the levels low?
Well, as he said, they flushed it as well as keep checking. I mean, I wasn't involved in this research. I'm doing my own research.
Well, what is your research about?
Yes, ma'am. I'm actually in my last semester at the Masters of Public Health program at FAMU, and I will be doing my research on the knowledge that the parents have on lead exposure in children, the different routes, the different ways that it can affect their children.
Oh, good. Well, we'll get to you in a minute.
Yes, ma'am.
You'll have a lot of things that you want to share. So what I hear you saying is that flushing the water addressed the problem. Okay. Now, how often do they need to flush the water? Because I would think when school is over, then that water sits there until the next morning, correct? I mean, am I thinking right?
You are correct. And before the students come in the next morning, the automatic flushing system, again, moves water through the pipes so that the levels of lead come down again. So this in one case, is automatic. The schools have done other things. They have cleaned the screens at the end of the faucet. They can accumulate lead from solder. Mm-hmm. And I think they have in mind, or they may have already removed some fittings and replaced them with ones that are lead-free.
Now, how does this – you said one school had an automatic flushing. So how is this done? Do they just manually turn this on every morning? I'm just concerned how
for schools that have an automatic flushing system, it's on a timer, and before school starts,
it
turns on and it flushes the pipes. Other schools, they're doing this manually. But as I say, Leon County Schools in particular has a longer-term plan, and they'll probably come up with many more actions to reduce lead.
What about Wakulla?
Their lead levels weren't as high, and I do believe they will follow the lead of Leon County. And, in fact, I would hope that I think Leon County is doing a very good job on this. I would hope that all 67 counties take a look at what Leon County is doing and follow their model.
How often are lead levels taken in the schools?
They're taken at least once a year, but I don't have as much information on that as perhaps I should. I will now check to see what the answers are.
Okay. Well, again, I just want to say much appreciation to all of you for coming and sharing this. As we talk about lead in the water, what is lead poisoning? McKenna?
Lead poisoning is, it's in various daily things that we deal with. It's in house dust, which is in paint chips, which is actually sweet to children when they put it in their mouth. It tastes like candy. Imported goods and toys and foods, they may have some dust on there from lead. There's also in gasoline. There has also been in the water pipes, as they stated before. I mean, lead poisoning has been around for...
So it's ubiquitous, it sounds
yes,
like.
Yes, ma'am. It definitely is. Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm.
Now, is there a difference between lead poisoning and lead toxicity, or are they synonymous? Is it the same thing? And I'm just throwing this out. Any of you feel free to address this.
Yeah, I feel personally that there's not too much difference because lead in its own form has no physiological function in the body, and so it's toxic to... basically all the vital organs in the body. But we are more concerned because of what it can do to children. So most times the effect of lead in the brain for children is irreversible. And like you said before, we even started this program, from hearing and listening problem to attention deficit and very many neurodevelopmental problems that could occur from lead poisoning. So basically there's really no difference between lead toxicity and lead poisoning, because lead is toxic and it's
no matter
toxic.
What.
Yeah.
Okay, and I appreciate that because I know in preparation for the program, I was reading where they were saying lead poisoning is synonymous with symptoms, and lead toxicity usually means you're asymptomatic, and I just wanted you to clarify that for me, so that's why I asked you that. I asked you to hold your thoughts for a minute. You're tuned in to 411 Teen, and we are going to school. I have Dr. Donald Axelrod and his students, graduate students in public health, who are giving us an education on lead in the water. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. Lead poisoning can affect every organ of the system that you have shared. Are there more, some organs that are more susceptible than others? And I'm thinking like the nervous system and the brain, and we're talking about children. Do you see that they are impacted more than other parts of the body?
Yes, children are more impacted with lead poisoning than other individuals because children are more vulnerable. They are more exposed. Ms. Boyd just explained the concept of candy and mouthing behaviors. Children tend to put their hands in their mouth more. They tend to be more active and tend to want to know more about their environment, so they get to be more exposed to lead. And not just the exposure, what it does on them too is actually more fascinating, and it's more, the adverse effect is even more pronounced in them than adults, because children tend to absorb lead faster, about 50% most times, than adults, because adults can easily excrete lead, but with children, most times it's not easy for them to eliminate it in their system. So it tends to cause seemingly overt symptoms like coma and death, to small symptoms that we sometimes cannot see, that you just mentioned, learning problems, attention deficit, attention disorder, and other seemingly subtle symptoms that people might not know for a long time.
And I also would think the fact that children are still developing, and so their brains are still developing,
yes,
that would have
point.
A significant role.
Yes.
Whereas with adults, I mean, everything is developed at that point.
Yes, ma'am.
So that's where I would guess it would impair future development. You know, that's where we're seeing that hyperactivity and all those other things coming because they're still growing and maturing. So what I'm hearing from you all, and you ought to correct me if I'm wrong, is that this really is a condition that is preventable.
Yes, ma'am. Yes.
I mean, am I right in saying it in that way?
Yes, ma'am. Yes.
The best researchers in lead toxicity make that statement. Lead toxicity is a totally preventable circumstance. And we have known the causes, we have known the effects, we have known the sources for many, many years, and we just have failed to deal with it.
Why?
I think it's because the exposure is uneven. And to explain that, as regards water, everyone's exposed, and everyone, therefore, gets concerned about it and wants to take action. But water is a lesser issue than some other matters, such as lead paint in old homes and lead plumbing in old homes and lead in soils from vehicle traffic. We used to have lead in gasoline. So there's a follow-up article to the Flint issue a couple weeks ago. Reuters news agency reported 3,000 sites around the U.S. where children had higher lead levels than in Flint. Now, these children are of lower socioeconomic status, as we call it, and I hate
poor
to say
kids,
it. Yes,
poor
I hate
kids.
To say
Let's
it.
Let's call it like it is. You know, poor kids.
Exactly, poor kids. I hate to
so
say
we're
it,
talking
but
about black and brown,
black and Latino, and we're not dealing with it well. I mean, we started a program of remediation of homes. I'm thinking about 40 years ago. But it's still very incomplete. We have on the order of 25 million old homes with lead paint. We have 4 million homes where children are overexposed. In the 0 to 5-year-old age class of American children, 500,000 of them are experiencing lead poisoning. There's another 90,000 every year. And it's quite irresponsible not to deal with it. The reason we focused on lead and water is, again, the political will is there to do something about it. And secondly, it is quick and cheap to fix it. You put a filter, at worst, at the end of the tap, and it's done. Now, for the houses, we may need $10,000 per home to remediate, and that's a big bill. But nonetheless, if you look at the cost-benefit ratio, the increase in IQ and the increase in earnings and the decrease in children ending up as adults in prison, we're still much better off dealing with the problem.
Well, there might be some benefit to keeping sending some groups to prison and keeping them at a certain level. And I'm not being facetious. I'm being very serious about that. You know, I mean, it might be, you know, we talk about the political will, but I don't know if the political will is there or not. It seems like it's very easy to address this issue, yet it's not being addressed. I want to go back to, because you covered some things that I wanted to make sure my listening audience got very clearly. What I hear you saying is that the cause of lead poisoning can be in what we eat, can be in what we drink, can be in what we breathe. I mean, so it's coming from all around, right? I mean,
yes,
you're nodding
ma'am.
Your head.
Touching, yes, ma'am. It's in everything. Like, even when their parents come home, and they may have been in construction or working in soil, and they touch their kids without showering or taking off their shoes before they enter the house, and they get exposed to lead.
Okay. Can we go over just what causes lead poisoning? And by that, I mean where it's coming from. I know what you're saying, but I want to hear it again a little bit slower so that, you know, folks can understand that it is literally, it's all around us, okay? It's not over there in that group. It's everywhere, okay? So do we find it in food? And if we find it in food, how does it get in food? Anyone want to share?
It is occasionally in food, and it's most evident for crops grown in high lead soil. So if you've got an urban garden, you're more at risk. I would say that the number one source as regards children who have excessive lead exposure is paint chips.
Okay.
And you think about this. You're in an old house, and the paint is flaking off the walls. It falls down. It's stepped on. It becomes dust. Now, as Mr. Fossekin said, children have hand-to-mouth behavior. They're also right at the floor level. They're breathing this dust. So that's the number one source.
And it tastes good. Didn't you say
yes,
it's kind of sweet?
It does taste sweet.
Okay, so you got that too.
Another, which would surprise some people, is dust in the outdoor air. From 1922 to starting in 1976, we used lead in gasoline. It was, to my way of thinking, the most irresponsible environmental health decision ever made in this country.
Why was it used? What was supposed to be the benefit, if you don't mind?
The benefit was anti-knocking. It gave engines better mileage and made them run more silently. Mm-hmm. But I suspect there were other solutions. In fact, we don't use it now, so obviously there are other solutions.
Mm-hmm.
But we put an amazing amount of lead in the atmosphere, and we ended up breathing it. And it's still available to us. It fell to the ground. It's in soil near roads. And when it's dry and the wind comes up, it gets placed into the air, and we breathe it. In fact, before Flint had its lead in water issue, they had a lead in air issue, and that every summer and early autumn, when the soil was dry, the winds kicked up, the children's blood lead levels spiked because of the lead in the air. So number one, paint chips. Number two, lead from gasoline and soil being suspended in the air. And then we have, of course, lead in water. We have lead in toys, and we have lead in stained glass. We have lead in ceramic, pottery. It's something we use extensively. In fact, looking up some numbers, the Romans mined about 10 tons of lead a year. We presently mined 10 million tons of lead a year. And consequently, the blood lead level for people before lead was mined in great abundance was about 1/60th. That is 1.6% of what it is today. So we have dispersed lead all around the planet, and we suffer the consequences. Another broad point, I would say we've made great progress here. Lead levels in children has gone from about 15 in 1976 to about 1 today. 1 still may be too high, but more to the point, it's not that everyone has 1. 2.5% of children are 5 and above, and that is lead poisoning. And the predominance of those children are poor. And we really, as a nation, should not be allowing that to happen when we know how to deal with it.
Yeah, I agree. But, you know, there are other variables playing there that have to do with why people get it. And when they look like me and some of these other folks that sit at the table, that's the reason. That's enough. Explain to me, and I know you all have said this a couple of times, but address what is a safe level. So no level is safe. 0 is what it should be. But then, I looked in CDC, and the CDC was saying 5 or 10 micrograms of lead per deciliter, and then EPA was saying 15. I mean, can you elaborate and explain to me and the listening audience exactly where it needs to be? The Academy of Pediatrics was saying 1. So,
yeah. As Ola Skuma said and Don said, no level is safe.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So the best level should be 0.
0. Okay.
Yes.
And who can we look at the at-risk populations just a little bit? I know your emphasis is children, but there are other populations that are at risk. And I'm thinking about pregnant women, okay? They're at high risk. So could you share or identify some of the other high-risk populations?
Pregnant women, certainly, they will pass on lead to their child. People in occupations that they use lead.
Can I just go back a minute? Yeah. When we say pregnant women, how do they pass it? Is it through the placenta?
Yes.
And then also, what about nursing mothers? Do they pass it through their breast milk? I mean, just for, again, you got to be real basic here, okay?
Yeah.
to help the listening audience have an appreciation for just how where it is. It's ubiquitous. It's every place. And, you know, so can we talk about that? So with pregnant women, they pass it through the placenta.
It mainly accumulates, it mainly passes from the mother to the fetus via blood.
Okay.
Women exposed to lead will get higher blood lead levels, and that blood will be passed on to the fetus. So the child could be overexposed. And that is a danger, given this is such a potent neurotoxin.
Mm-hmm.
We all want our children to be as smart as possible, and avoiding exposure to lead is absolutely essential if we want that outcome.
Okay. Can you make a distinction, and I say can you, but can all of you, any one of you, make the distinction between, and I don't know if this is the correct way, acute contamination and then chronic contamination?
Yeah, acute contamination occurs within 24 hours, and if a child is exposed to very high lead levels, it's possible that you could start seeing things like seizures, convulsions. The child could get into coma and probably die. But a chronic exposure takes over time. It could take months, it could take years, it could take, years basically. And the effects are not seen until the child is old and probably in the teens and when they are 20 and all of those things. And you start seeing attention deficit problem. You see some becoming aggressive and all of these neurodevelopmental problems that could be seen.
And talking about the contaminated water, can you shower? And that was something that was a bit unclear with me when they were going through the whole Clint stuff. Can you shower? Some people were saying, oh, it's okay to shower, but you can't drink. So can you shower in it? And what purpose does boiling the water serve? I don't understand how, and I admit I'm real basic, but boiling water doesn't seem like it would make any difference to me.
Yeah, because lead is even more soluble in
when it's hot.
Hot water.
That's okay. Okay. All right, so my listening audience, what we're saying is boiling water does not help. It does not make any difference. And showering, now, can you shower or can you not shower? What's the deal on that?
We would not take up much lead through our skin. So
okay.
if it's a Flint situation, I would say they could bathe and shower.
Okay.
They certainly should not be drinking at the high lead levels that they had.
Okay. All right. Another question is, does it make a difference if it's organic or inorganic poisoning?
Inorganic is the type that's in the Flint water, and that does not get through the skin.
Okay.
Organic lead will go right through your skin into your bloodstream. And I'm happy to say we're not using much of that anymore. It used to be common in gasoline, and we stopped putting it in gasoline, so we really don't run into organic lead much.
Okay. Now, once somebody has lead poisoning, what are the tissues that lead is stored in the body? I mean, like, blood, is it the bone? Where do you find the highest levels?
In the blood. Well, I would say in the blood.
Okay. I mean, I don't know. I believe.
The blood certainly reflects the exposure, but most of the lead is in your bones and teeth. And it remains there for a long time. And in blood, it half of it disappears every 30 days. In bone, it can take years. And even if you stop being exposed to lead, you may still have blood lead levels as a result of bone transferring lead to blood.
Okay. So now, is there a half-life? And if so, what's the half-life for it in the bone? And then I guess being in the bone would be different than being in the bloodstream.
Right.
Okay.
Half-life for lead in blood is about 30 days. For lead in bone, it's more like 20 years.
Okay. So if you got it in the bone, then you're not in too bad a shape. Okay. Hair and nails, is it in that? How do we address that? I mean, I know y'all are looking at me like, this woman knows nothing. I'm just wondering, I mean, you know, because all of this is real basic for, you know, is it in the hair? And if it's in the hair, you know, do you have to worry about it because you lose your hair or people cut their hair and nails? I mean, am I questioning make much sense?
Yes. In fact, today I was writing a lecture on mercury, which is also a neurotoxicant and does appear at high concentrations in the hair and the nails. But I'm not aware that that lead does. It's mm-hmm. mercury in the hair and the nails, not lead.
Okay. All right. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. And again, I appreciate you coming. We are talking about lead poisoning, how it impacts individuals, children, adults, where it is. It's every place around us. We're going to take a break, but we're going to come back. And when we come back, we're going to talk about prevention. We're going to talk also about the diagnosis of it and how it's removed from the body. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. We are talking about lead poisoning. How is lead removed from the body? I mean, is it removed by feces or, you know, sweat or urine or blood? Can you share that with us?
All of the above.
Oh, okay.
It is removed through the kidney via feces. And again, in blood, it's got a 30-day half-life. You mentioned if there are means to detoxify a child, and if a child is severely lead poisoned, MDs will recommend chelation therapy, and chelation therapy will remove some of the lead, but I think often it's too late. There's already neurological damage, and chelation won't reverse that.
What does chelation therapy involve?
It involves giving a child a dose of a chemical that binds with lead, and mm-hmm. then that lead is excreted from the body.
Okay. How is lead poisoning diagnosed? Is it just simply a blood test?
It can be a blood test, and in fact, the AMA recommends a blood test, I believe, at 1 year and 2 years. There needs to be better compliance with that, given our ready exposure to lead. But how is it diagnosed? Often behavioral problems, learning problems, erratic behavior. In severe.
They're not just bad kids, because all of that sounds like, you know, depending on what school you go to and what's your zip code, that would just be, you know, incorrigible bad kids.
You know, how many kids behaving like that does it take before certain groups are stereotyped?
Not many. Not many, yeah. I think that's important to hear. As far as the symptoms, you said we know what the symptoms are, and I guess I just wonder how they distinguish that it, I guess, just the blood. As I'm talking, I'm thinking just the blood level and the test would tell you. Because, again, these symptoms can look like so many other things. I mean, constipation, problems with sleeping, you know, a lack of energy or interest. Or sounds like, again, it could be so many other things.
20% of ADHD is ascribed to lead exposure. So it's a significant issue. And you're right, for low-level exposure, what we see is kids not learning well and having behavioral problems and having attention problems. And teachers should be aware that that could be a sign of lead exposure. We really need to test kids to see that they're not overexposed. But what's called primary prevention is we eliminate the sources. Mm-hmm. We don't want to have to deal with ill kids.
Right.
We want to prevent kids from getting ill. It's a much better solution. And it would take some expenditure. But as a moral issue, we should do it. And as an economic issue, we'd still end up well ahead of the game if we made sure kids develop to their full potential.
And I know there's a correlation between lead toxicity in prenatal and early childhood and juvenile delinquency. I've read that. I know that as far as psychology is concerned, and violent crime in adulthood. We had the whole incident, and I have a blank in his name, with the young man in Baltimore that was killed, and they found
Freddie Gray.
Yes, that he had high lead levels. Okay, I mean that's an excellent example of what is going on. Of course, Freddie Gray had his skin was the wrong color. Okay.
His blood lead levels are very high, and they could explain his behavior. In the report that came out of Flint, Michigan, the state body put out a final report on responsibility. But in that report, they have a diagram of costs as a result of the exposures. And the number one cost is loss of income because of reduced IQ. But there's also costs ascribed to putting teenagers in the penal system and adult crime and things of this nature. And you look at that and you think to yourself, wouldn't it be better if we dealt with that? In fact,
if you're into prisons, it might not be better.
For Flint, it's estimated it would cost $100 a day to put anti-corrosive chemicals in the water. And the cost to Michigan is estimated to be about $500 million from the loss of IQ and the behavioral and criminal problems that may result.
But I guess it doesn't matter. It doesn't seem to be significant. Okay. Are any of this lead poisoning, is any of it reversible?
It is not believed to be. I'm reading on this topic now. I haven't seen anything saying that it can be, loss of IQ can be reversed. Now, we scientists, we never accept an answer. We keep looking to see if new data indicates something different. And I'd like to think it could be reversed, but I've seen nothing to date saying it can be.
Okay. And I wondered about that because I know it couldn't be reversed if it has an impact on the central nervous system. So how are you going to reverse damage on that? One report I read said, yes, that it was possible to do some reversing on kidney and kidneys and blood. So that's why I threw that question out there to you, because it just didn't make a lot of sense to me. Because lead has been identified, I know it was identified as one of the largest environmental medicine problems. Yet it's one that can be, again, very easily addressed. Now, I guess the United States is in the forefront compared to some other countries, correct? Not talk about that some, please.
We certainly do very good research in this country, so we've identified the problem and the causes. As far as regulation, I think we're far behind some other countries. As far as banning lead and paint, I think we were 50 years behind some European countries. The same with lead and gasoline. And as far as remediation, whatever other countries have done, we're not doing enough. I mean, when we have millions of homes with lead paint in them, it's a problem. And we have these issues such as, should a landlord be able to rent a home that's full of flaking lead paint to a family? And the law on that varies between states, and it ought not be. It's absolutely unacceptable to expose children to flaking lead paint in a rented property.
Or just paint over it. Because if a child is playing, you know, and just picking on that paint, even if they paint it over it, they're going to eventually get down, you know, to the lead. And that, again, that gets back to what you were saying, Maclena, but that it tastes good. And kids, that's going to be a real appeal. Would you elaborate a little bit more on your work? We got a few minutes that you're doing.
I will be doing a survey that I will be giving out to the Tallahassee community, and it's basically, what is your knowledge on lead in paint, in water, in soil? How do you have you ever had your child's blood lead level tested? If so, did the doctor? If not, did the doctor mention about your child's blood lead level to you? Just basically, there. Do they understand that the lead is in all of these different things? It is all around us. How does it affect the children? Do they understand when the children does become aggressive, there may be signs that it's actually lead in their blood rather than they're just acting out or being bad? Mm-hmm. Or if somebody says maybe a doctor says, you know, they might have ADD. Well, did you ask them where did it come from, or how did they accumulate ADD? Are you just accepting it? Because, you know, sometimes in African-American communities, they say your child has ADD. Oh, okay, put them on.
The ADD, they're either developmentally delayed.
Exactly. Yeah. Instead of asking questions, parents just, you know, accept it. Or some parents do ask questions, but I'm basically wanting to have the parents get them thinking about lead exposure in their children and how it affects their children.
Okay. Are you all involved in any research, anything that you'd like to share with us?
Yes, sir.
Would you share it? Yes.
Yes, personally. Building upon the work which we started, yes, so basically, I'm trying to look at comparing lead levels, looking at different states and different counties. So that is basically, that would be my research in my master's. So that's what my target would be, is to see what other counties, as he said, that other counties must also look at what Leon County and Wakulla has done and then take it up. And then do it. So we are trying to look at whether it has been done, and if it's done, we are trying to compare the results and see what other states or other counties are doing better than us, which can do to change. And also,
when will you have that completed?
I'm about starting, so
what you're doing, I think, is fascinating, and it would be good to come and share. And what about you?
Yes. Right now, I'm working on understanding the impact water lead levels have on blood lead levels. So I'm going to run a model that actually predicts that if you take this amount of lead through water, this is the level that lead is going to spike in your blood. And not just water alone, I'm also considering other sources. The model is going to actually look into other sources, air, soil, dust, and everything, to actually model that if you take this amount of lead into your system, this is how your blood is going to increase. And all of this is to make sure that we come up with primary prevention strategies that are proactive and not reactive, like the secondary prevention he mentioned, which is about giving chelating agents when the damage is already done.
Let me ask you about the long-term effect of lead. And I'm talking about, does it decrease the lifespan? Is it carcinogenic and we're running out of time? But are those things that we need to be aware of?
Yeah, there's a lot to be aware of about lead. It's not just about life. It's about the social cost, like Dr. Axera just mentioned, not quite long. How much of money are we going to lose if people keep getting exposed to lead? If crime rates reduce, how much is the government going to put into building jails, building hospitals? Let's put it that way. Sometimes when people get exposed to lead, overall, the social cost of lead poisoning will be quite enormous. It will be quite enormous. Like you mentioned, there's a lot of millions and billions that will be lost when people's IQ is very low, when children lose their childhood, basically. And you just mentioned an example of a bright young man who could have grown up to be an exceptional person in the world for a degree, mm-hmm. who lost his life. And there could be millions of that. And in public health and in medicine generally, it is first, do no harm. Try to make sure people are well. Try to make sure people are good. And the message out there is primary prevention, which is what we basically talk about in the Institute of Public Health, to make sure that this lead does not even get to people, basically.
Mm-hmm. Okay. When you look at lead and you look at age-related issues, what do you see? And when I say age-related issues, I mean we've got the young folks and we've got the old folks. And I know your focus is on young. But what happens with older? What happens with adults who have had lead poisoning?
They are also affected.
Mm-hmm.
Adults are also affected. But we know that the effect is more on children compared mm-hmm. to adults, but adults are also affected.
But they still have the same kinds of symptoms?
They also may have cardiovascular symptoms mm-hmm. that may affect them as an adult.
Okay.
Kidney problems, reproductive problems.
Okay. All right. But I know, and it makes sense, of course, the focus would be on young folks,
yeah.
and it would be on, you know, where we can go before it's been in their system for a long time. Okay, so I understood that. What about the effects of lead? How about plants and animals? And I'm thinking now like about farm animals and pets and wildlife. It just seems like all of that, and maybe I'm headed in the wrong direction, but it just seems like everything would be affected because it's everywhere.
Yes, as he said in describing one of the means of getting exposed to lead, he said so when you plant a crop at where mm-hmm. we have lead more in the soil, which means that the plant picks up the chemicals. So which means that in a way, we can get it in foodstuffs as well.
Right.
So, and if you're feeding animals with chemicals and as well, you get they get exposed to those chemicals as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we can see that, as we know, it is all around us. And most of the things that we do or most of the things that we come in contact with are all exposed to lead as well.
To you students, what was the appeal for going into public health?
Me personally, I want to be a health inspector. So when I looked up the requirements, it was Masters of Public Health could help benefit me in becoming a health inspector.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also interested, I chose my focus to be environmental health because I am interested in lead and mercury and how they affect human population, animals as well. So that's what drove me.
Okay.
For me, it's epidemiology and biostatistics, looking at how public health, I see public health, the basics of public health to be biostatistics and epi,
mm-hmm.
because you know need to know the numbers, just like how we get to know that, okay, this number of people have been affected by this. So yes, that's where my interest came from. Yes, to be able to know how many people are affected by an illness or a lead.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where my interest came from. And also to build up on things that I've come to learn mm-hmm. as well. Yes, that's it.
My own story is quite simple. I started with biochemistry. And in biochemistry, I was just understanding how things go at the cellular level. I worked with cadmium and I saw the devastating effect it had on the cells of mm-hmm. Rats. And I was quite fascinated by the concept of toxicology, which basically is like the dose makes the poison. So I thought to myself, if this could be happening at this level to rats, and all I was seeking then was the silver bullet. Let us look for a drug that makes sure these symptoms go away. Public health gave me this eye-opening that there are bigger things that could be done at the population level to make sure that this does not even get to people at all.
Well, Dr. Axelrad, would you bring your students back? Because it's certainly fascinating what they're doing and very relevant. So I would love to have them come back and make, when they finish and talk about what they found out.
Certainly. I'd be happy to bring the students back. I'm very proud of them. They're quite knowledgeable on this issue, and they're very enthusiastic about it.
To my listening audience, that's it for this edition of 411 Teen. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. This edition of 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistant, Ken Smith. Audio copies are available, and if you want to participate in 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Teen podcast, log in wfsu.org. Check us out on Facebook.